I grew up in the 70s, and they talk about the recession of the 70s, where, you know, I remember literally going and taking my car. Some of you might remember this kind of deal. I remember going and taking my car at night before, and going to the local gas station, which already had about 30 cars in line, and I'd get my car in line. Someone would drive me home. I would go to bed. I'd get up the next morning, go get in my car so I could be in line to get gas. Anybody remember those gas lines? Yeah. I mean, what was going on there? That was insane. I mean, oil is part of the world's wealth, right? In more recent history, you know, going back a decade or so, you remember how these lending companies, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, had to be rescued by the government because they were failing, and banks like Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And what about the people? You know, anybody recognize the name Bernie Madoff? What about the people that invested with him? And he was running this pyramid scheme and promising, you know, consistent returns on your money. But there were no returns. There were no real investments. It was just all a pyramid scheme. And his clients lost millions of dollars, and ultimately he got thrown into jail. And so you only have to be even a casual observer of the news and world events to realize that wealth is very unstable. You might have it today, and you may not have it tomorrow. It's as transitory, if I can maybe use a local illustration, wealth is as transitory as that new flower bloom in a spring hailstorm. It's here, and all of a sudden, it's gone. Well, many of us think, or did think at one time, that more wealth would be the solution to many of our problems, that more wealth would be the key to great happiness, but the reality is nothing could be farther from the truth. The Bible is very relevant to our lives. It speaks to us in a very plain fashion, as James does here today. And James 5 could almost be a commentary on some of the things that we see happening in our world today. And as James approaches this topic of wealth, And we consider this morning, you might be tempted to say, well, that doesn't apply to me because I'm not wealthy. I'm not one of the world's wealthy people. So the first thing we need to do, I think, is make clear that we don't have to be rich, as in, you know, millionaire or thousandaire, you know, or have any kind of significant nest egg in the bank or possess some of the world's stuff to be considered wealthy. Wealth is really kind of relative. While most of us wouldn't consider ourselves wealthy, there are plenty of people who would look at any one of us and consider us to be wealthy. You know, sometimes we think of ourselves in relation to people that are higher up the economic ladder than we are. We see them as wealthy, and we see us as maybe poor. Or if not poor, then maybe at least, you know, we don't consider ourselves to be in the wealthy category. But there are people in the world that would consider us very wealthy, like maybe some of the folks in this picture. It's all relative when you think about wealth and poverty. I don't know any place in our country, it might exist, I've never seen it, I've never been there, that looks anything like any of those pictures. And even the reality is that homeless people in our country today have access to things that those folks have no access to, like government help, you know, food stamps, a corner where wealthy people pass every day and can throw a dollar or two at them or go get them a Happy Meal at McDonald's and hand it to them through the car window, you know. And so the idea is that wealth is really quite relative, and any of us sitting in the auditorium today, in the sanctuary today, would be considered wealthy by those standards. So, wealth is relative, and we have to remember that. So let's put it in perspective. You know, you might be here this morning, you might be out of work, you might be collecting unemployment, you might be struggling to put food on the table, or struggling to make the rent or the mortgage, or struggling to pay your bills, or living paycheck to paycheck. And I don't want to minimize your difficulties, and we've all had places in our life where we've had financial difficulties. I can remember times in our life where, you know, we just kind of waited for the next paycheck so we could go buy the next gallon of milk. And so those are, you know, those are times that are a bit hard to get through, but we have to wonder if the people in the pictures on the screen would consider us even in that condition to be wealthy or poor like them. So please understand, the Bible never condemns wealth, never condemns being wealthy. It only condemns a wrong attitude toward wealth, and it condemns a wrong use of wealth. And it's on that point that James speaks to us. He shows us an example of a wealthy person in these first six verses, someone that has a wrong attitude toward the wealth that he has accumulated. And he addresses the wealthy. Look at verse 1. Come now, you rich. James is talking to rich people here. And the reason for the past few minutes of introduction were to help us to realize that you and I, we really are rich. We might not be rich as in Bill Gates rich or Warren Buffett rich, but we're rich. And we have some control over some of this world's wealth, regardless of how much that is. We have some control over it in our own personal lives. But we need to understand that the Bible never condemns wealth. It only condemns the wrong attitude toward wealth. So James addresses these wealthy people, and it's not money, but the love of money, the Bible says, that's the root of all evil, 1 Timothy 6:10. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. So money itself is an evil. Being rich is not evil. The Bible does tell us that being wealthy can be dangerous. Being wealthy can put us in a position where we experience temptations that those that are not wealthy do not experience. But it never condemns wealth itself. And it's clear from the context in our passage today that James is addressing those who have a wrong attitude toward wealth and those who are misusing their wealth. The context also suggests, and this is a little important for the context, especially in what will follow next week, that the rich of verses 1 through 6 are not believers. James is talking not to the believing rich, but to the unbelieving rich, although the principles certainly apply across the board. Now, why do we say that the context suggests that they are not believers? Well, when James addresses them in verse 1, he doesn't do as he does in other places in the book and address them as brothers. He doesn't say, you brothers, or, you know, come now, brothers. He just calls them, you rich. And so he almost seems to be addressing them as if they are outside of the church. And then another reason is that the following verses, as we pick up in verse 7 next week, the following verses are addressed to believers, and they're connected to verses 1 through 6. So you'll see in the beginning of verse 7, James says, therefore. Therefore. And there's the therefore is always there for some reason. And it's a connecting word. And so the therefore in verse 7 has something to do with the first six verses of James 5. And what it has to do with is James addresses the rich in the first six verses and really just brings a tongue-lashing of an indictment against them. And then he says, therefore, and now he's going to address those who are being mistreated by the rich and tells them that under this mistreatment, under this suffering that they are experiencing at the hands of the rich people, to be patient. And so then he addresses brethren. So you'll see, if you look at the contrast, verse 1 of chapter 5, come now you rich, and verse 7, therefore be patient, brethren. And so these brethren are told, these brothers are told how to respond to the abuses of the rich. The rich in verses 1 through 6 have gotten their wealth by evil means. They've squandered their wealth on sinful living, and they've used their wealth selfishly. And James tells them to weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon them. That's pretty severe language, isn't it? He tells them to weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon them. See, there are consequences to materialism, and there are consequences to the wrong use, the misuse of wealth, consequences that ultimately bring sorrow. That's why the end of 1 Timothy 6:10 talks about the rich piercing themselves with many pangs, because wealth can bring great misery if it's not handled in a godly way. And so James tells them that miseries are coming upon them because of their ill-gotten gain. And although these verses are primarily addressed to unbelievers, they do serve as a warning to us, and the principles apply across the board. So what do we learn in these first six verses of James chapter 5 concerning wealth and misery? Well, I think the first thing we learn is that wealth can make us miserable because of how we acquire it. Wealth can make us miserable because of how we acquire it. How did the people in James' day acquire their wealth? Well, we find out in verse 4. James says, "Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you." And so what he's saying is that these rich people who already have more money than they could possibly ever spend have hired people to mow their fields, and that would have been, you know, the exchange that James is talking about here, the economic exchange. They've hired people to mow their fields, but they haven't paid them for it. They withhold their pay because they don't want to let go of their money. They don't want to give it to the people that have worked for them and earned this pay. And so this was a problem in those days, and as it still is in some cases today. And there are abuses in the workplace today. There are abuses in employment practices today sometimes where companies can get things out of their employees without paying them for them, or where perhaps individual people who run a small business will do shady things even regarding their employees, where they're not giving them what they deserve in pay for the work that has been rendered. God says in Jeremiah 23:13, "Woe to him who uses his neighbor's services without pay." That's an interesting biblical principle, isn't it? Woe to him who uses his neighbor's services without pay. In other words, if you're going to hire someone to do something for you, you've got to pay them. You've got to give them what you told them you would give them, we're not to take advantage of one another. And this is just one example of ill-gotten gain, but the principle is that it is wrong to accumulate wealth by cheating, by fraud, by dishonesty. It's wrong for us to accumulate wealth, and remember, this isn't just for the, Warren Buffetts of the world. This is for all of us here this morning, because we have some of this world's goods, and it's wrong for us to accumulate any of our wealth by dishonest means. At the extreme end of materialism is the attitude that says wealth is so important to me that it doesn't matter how I get it. Wealth is so important to me that it doesn't matter how I get it, as long as I get it. And that means that people will oftentimes do shady things in order to get that wealth. They'll go to incredible lengths of dishonesty. So we see this all the time in business, right? And even in advertising on television and in your dealings with people through the years. Maybe one company will lie about the competition and say untrue things about them because they want your business. Or a company will fudge the numbers on the books. And big corporations do this all the time. They have ways to kind of juggle the numbers so that, when they bring out their quarterly or annual reports, the business actually looks better than it really is. Or they might misrepresent the product being sold. I don't know why. I love infomercials. Anybody here love infomercials? I don't buy anything from them. I just think they're incredibly entertaining. I remember there was a guy, I haven't seen him in a long time, but this guy, Ron Popeil, would sell everything. I mean, he invented thousands of things, and one of these things he invented, it blows my mind that he ever sold one can of this, was spray-on hair. Anybody remember that stuff? And he'd show a bald guy, and he'd just take a can and spray it, and the guy had this big full head of hair. And all it was color, and he just coloring that part of your scalp to match your hair. And I mean, this commercial was on for years, which means people had to be buying this stuff. Well, you know, the guy was just robbing you of your money if you bought that. I mean, come on. You know. Or people do work that doesn't need to be done. I haven't had this experience in years, so maybe these particular types of businesses have gotten a lot better. I don't know. But I remember when we were first married, in the early years of our marriage, I dreaded taking my car to get tires or an oil change or anything like that. You know why? Inevitably, the mechanic would come out and say, "Can I talk to you, sir?" And say, "Well, yeah, what's the problem?" "Well, you need shocks and struts and springs and a new muffler. And, you know, this tire is bad. And I mean, and, well, how much is all that going to cost?" And he'd show you this number that was like, "I was going to go buy a new car. I mean, I can't afford to fix all that stuff." But most of it, there was nothing wrong with it because they were just crooks. And they were just doing stuff, you know, to... I remember there was a whole expose on one of the big news things one time where these shops were taking squirt cans of oil and they'd spray them on people's shocks. And they'd take you out to show you they were leaking. So you needed new ones. And this is the kind of thing that James is talking about here. And so the first step toward a proper attitude and the proper use of wealth is to make sure that every penny and every possession that we have was acquired through totally honest means. The non-materialistic person puts character above wealth. It's more important who you are than what you possess. And so we have to ask ourselves, can we say that we've come by our wealth honestly, or do we have to compromise our character to get it? The Bible says that ill-gotten gain will ultimately lead to misery and not happiness. And you know, we see it all the time how people's lives are ruined because of the way they have pursued their wealth. You might remember, again, I mean, we could pick any number of hundreds of stories, but the one that came to my mind as I was thinking about this was Charles Rangel, who is the chairman of the House and Ways Means Committee, which happens to be, you know, the committee that takes care of all the tax laws. And he was indicted for all kinds of financial appropriations, and some of it had to do with taxes. And he wound up losing his position and, you know, all kinds of bad stuff. And that's why James says, "Weep and howl, you rich, for the miseries that are coming upon you." Wealth can make us miserable. It can bring all kinds of pangs upon us. Wealth itself isn't bad. Being wealthy isn't bad. But if we don't know how to handle it, if we misuse it, if we have a wrong attitude toward it, it can bring a great deal of misery. Secondly, we learn that wealth can make us miserable because of how we use it. How we use it. You know, you can earn all your wealth and acquire all your possessions in a totally honest way and still be and still misuse it once you get it. So the next problem is for the man in James 5 is how he uses his wealth. And the rich in our passage have misused their wealth in two ways. And that misuse has brought and is going to bring misery, God says. And so the first way they've misused it is by hoarding their wealth, by hoarding it. Look at verses 2 and 3. He says to the rich, "Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure." James talks to these people, and he basically condemns them for hoarding their wealth. And now, understand, again, because we don't want to go to extremes here. We need to understand there's a balance. There's nothing wrong with saving. If you have money in the bank, it doesn't mean you're hoarding your wealth. There's nothing wrong with saving. In fact, the Bible encourages saving. Proverbs 6:6-8. We looked at this verse last week, interestingly enough. "Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief officer or ruler, she prepares her bread in the summer and gathers her food in harvest. And so, you know, the ant stores up for when there's not going to be any food. And then in Proverbs 10:5, it says, he who gathers in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps in the harvest is a son who brings shame. Joseph, you remember Joseph, he knew there was a 7-year famine coming, so he saved up. You know, it wasn't pennies in the bank, it was grain in the silo. He saved up for the coming 7-year famine. So there's nothing wrong with saving, but there is everything wrong with hoarding. And the rich in our passage are hoarding their wealth. And we see that because their stuff is rotting and rusting. They can't even use everything that they have, and they would rather let it rot than give it away. That's some picture, isn't it? Their wealth is rotting and rusting. Did you ever save something because you didn't want to get rid of it, and you kind of just forgot about it? I'm talking about a material thing now, something, you know, you can put your fingers on, and you forgot about it. It was in a closet or in a barn or in a shed. And years later, it comes to your mind and you go to get it. And when you find it, it's no good anymore. It's full of mold. It has literally rusted, or it has rotted, or termites got at it, or some other bugs got in it. And you take the thing and you throw it away because it literally is no good anymore. It's the kind of thing James is talking about here. Well, why do people hoard? Well, sometimes people hoard because of fear. Hoarding sometimes is the result of being afraid there's not going to be enough for tomorrow. And so I've got to keep everything that I have. Again, nothing wrong with saving, but if I'm a hoarder, if I can't give anything away, if I can't release anything from my grip, then I'm a hoarder, and I might do that because I'm afraid that there won't be enough for tomorrow. But Jesus says in Matthew 6:34, therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. And that follows right on the heels of his talking about, you know, the birds of the air and the flowers of the field, and, you know, they don't toil or spin, but their Heavenly Father arrays them, and their Heavenly Father provides for them. And so we need to be wise and prudent. We need to save. We need to think about tomorrow. We need to not be foolish, but we must not hoard as a result of fear that there's not going to be enough for us tomorrow. And then sometimes people hoard because of selfishness. They're not necessarily worried about tomorrow. They know they have enough, but it's theirs, and they're not going to part with it. They're not going to give any away. They're not going to share any of it because life is all about me. And we talked about that a couple months ago. Life is all about me. And so sometimes it's just selfishness that causes people to hoard. But God says that we are to share some of what we have been given. It's interesting, the Bible speaks very highly of work, and that we are to work, and work is a good thing, and we're to work hard. And it says, you know, if a man will not work, neither let him eat. So the Bible is very serious about this thing called work, that you and I were made. Part of the way we're designed is that we're to work, we're to provide something that is of value, you know, back to society and the people around us. And when we work, we get paid for our work. Now, why do we get paid for our work? Well, some people think, well, we get paid for our work, so it's mine, and I can have it and put it in the bank and keep it and hoard it and be selfish with it. But God says there's another reason why we work, besides being able to provide for our needs, besides God giving you strength with your hands or strength with your mind to do something, to be able to have an income so that you can pay your own bills. Look what he says in Ephesians 4:28. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, let him work, doing honest work with his own hands so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Do you know that one of the reasons for work is so that when we earn our money, we have something that we can give away, something that we can share with someone else? The Bible makes it clear that our work and our income isn't all about us. It's about us having something to be able to provide for people who truly have need. Not people who don't want to work, because if a man will not work, neither let him eat. But someone who's unable to work, someone who's in a truly desperate situation, who has no way to provide for their own needs, and we work so that we have something that we can share. Another reason why people hoard is miserliness. They're just misers, and they just want to acquire as much as they can. In other words, it's never enough. I just need more, just a little bit more. And Proverbs 23:6 says, "Do not eat the bread of a miser, nor desire his delicacies." Psalm 37:21 says, in contrast to that, "The righteous is generous and gives." And so it's not good to be a miser and to hoard and to be selfish, but it's godly to give. So regardless of how much or how little we have, guess what we should all be doing? Giving something away. Giving some of what we have been blessed with away to others. And one of the themes that runs through this book of James is concern for the poor. So if we go back, for example, to James chapter 1, verse 27, James says, "Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and our Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world." When we were back there, we made a point to say that visiting orphans and widows in their distress wasn't simply showing up and saying hi. You know, it wasn't, "Hey, I'm here for a 5-minute visit, so, you know, we can have a little chat." It was to visit them in the sense of helping them and helping to provide for whatever it is that they might have need. So God is concerned about the poor. In James 2, 15 and 16, it says, "If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, be warmed and be filled,' and you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that?" James is concerned about the poor. In the first half of chapter 5, the chapter that we're looking at now, is all about the poor, the rich, and how they mistreat the poor, and the poor in their desperate situation. In James chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, James is concerned about our attitudes toward the rich and the poor, so that we don't show partiality. When the rich man comes into church, we say, "Oh, here, you come sit in the best seat." Oh, wait, that's not the best seat. That one all the way in the back is the best seat, because they're the first ones taken. These, you'll notice, there's not a person sitting in this front row. But he says he doesn't want us to show all this favoritism to the rich man. When the poor man comes, you say, "Oh, you go sit over in this place of dishonor." James, God is very concerned about the poor and about how you and I treat the poor, and it's addressed throughout this book of James. And then in 1 John 3:17, John says, "If anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him?" And so one of the proper uses of our wealth is to give some away. That when others have need and we have the ability to supply the need with what either we can't use or don't use, we would rather hoard it for ourselves, that is sin. And God doesn't bless us with wealth so we can store it away and watch it rot. He blesses us with wealth in part so we can help and bless others through us. 1 Timothy 6:18, Paul is writing this letter to Timothy, and he's talking to Timothy about how to instruct the rich of this world. And he says this in verse 18, "They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share." You and I are to be rich in good works, to be generous and to be ready to share some of what the Lord has given us. And then misery comes from wasting wealth, and we see that in verse 5. It says, "You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter." The rich in this passage were people who were living lives of self-indulgence. They were denying themselves nothing. And they used their wealth to satisfy every desire and every craving that they possibly could. They wasted their money pursuing pleasure. Notice three phrases James uses. Lived luxuriously on the earth. Led a life of wanton pleasure. That's extravagant self-indulgence. Fattened your hearts. That denied themselves nothing. Now, again, for balance, there's nothing wrong with enjoying nice things. We're told in 1 Timothy 6:17, again, addressing the rich, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. So there's a sense in which we work and we earn a living, we earn income. We saw earlier that one of the reasons is so we have something to give away. But here we learn it's also because God is giving us something to enjoy. It's okay to have something to enjoy as long as you're not using everything you have on what James calls wanton pleasure. And so one reason that God blesses us is so we can enjoy them. In 2 Timothy 3:4, Paul puts it in perspective when he says that these particular people that he's talking about are treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, and lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And sometimes we are just lovers of pleasure, lovers of our wealth rather than lovers of God. It's when our own comfort and our own pleasure takes precedence over God. It's when we love our pleasures more than we love God. Well, how do we know if we love pleasure more than we love God, if we love our wealth more than we love God? I think it's pretty simple. We just have to ask ourselves a question. What do we do with our money and our stuff? Remember Jesus said in Matthew 6:21, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Well, treasure follows our heart. And you can tell where a man's heart is by how he uses his treasure. And so here's a test for all of us. Do we not give some of our money, some of our wealth away? Do we not help those in need because we can't afford to? And there are people who say, well, I'd love to help you. You know, man, you're in a desperate place and I would love to help you, but I can't afford to help you. But the reality is we can afford to go out to eat. We can afford to take trips and vacations. We can afford to wear nice clothes and keep up with the latest fashions. And we can afford to satisfy our curiosity for the latest gadget, you know, upgrade to the iPhone, whatever next number it is. And live in a nice home that gets redecorated with all of the seasons of the year and drive a nice car. And again, there's not necessarily anything wrong with those things. But if we're saying we can't afford to do what God tells us to do and give some of it away, but we can afford to do all those other things, it really is a reflection of our heart and the condition of our heart. God has blessed us abundantly in this country. And you know, we have a lot of problems. We really do. But I still can't think of any place that I'd rather live than in our country. It's still an extremely blessed place. And even in times of recession, even in times of personal financial leanness, we are a very, very, very rich people in comparison to some other folks in different parts of the world. And so we need to not misuse what God has given us. And then thirdly, wealth can make us miserable because of how we lose it, how we lose it. James says the wealthy will lose their wealth. Verse 2, your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. That means they're no good anymore. Verse 3, your gold and your silver have rusted and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. Well, one way or another, we will all lose our wealth. I mean, think about what you consider your wealth. Money, jewelry, investments, cars, antiques, clothing, all of it, whatever it is, you're going to lose it. I guarantee it. In fact, I'll super guarantee it. You're not going to keep it. It's going away. It will either rust, rot, or decay, or be destroyed. Someone might steal it. You know, you might be one of the several folks who parked your car around town one day and came back to find the window broken and stuff gone from your car. Someone might steal it. It might be destroyed. Or eventually you're just going to pass it on to someone else when you die. I mean, you don't get to take it with you, right? The ancient Egyptian pharaohs thought they could take it with them. That's why they built these great pyramids. And they would get their bodies would be embalmed and they would be put in these sarcophagus and all their riches would be put around them so they could take it with them into the next world. Well, the joke's on them because their riches are now artifacts in our museums. And they couldn't take it with them. It was impossible. Someone was curious about John D. Rockefeller when he died, and they wanted to know, how much did he leave behind? And the answer was all of it. All of it. You can't take it with you. And if we're driven by materialism, then when we lose our stuff to whatever, it will bring misery upon us. No wealth lasts forever. Ultimately, it will all be burned up in that final day of the Lord. Read 2 Peter. There's a day coming, Peter says, when this present heavens and earth will pass away with a roar and a fervent, intense heat. It's all going away. That beautiful home, the diamond ring, the bank account, the car, you name it. If you have it, it's going. It's temporary. And it's interesting that James says your gold and your silver have corroded. Because the thing about gold is it doesn't corrode, right? It just endures. It's enduring. And yet James says, in kind of a play on words, your gold and your silver have corroded, because what he's saying to them is even those things that you consider to be enduring are going away. They will not last. And he uses that terminology to drive that home. You know, someone suggested putting a label on all of our stuff with the words "to be burned." Just do that. So that you're reminded that all this stuff you have someday is going to pass away when the Lord comes and this heaven and these heavens and earth are destroyed by fire. And whatever it is, I mean, just remind yourself it's going to be burned. And whether it's gold or silver or your house or your clothing or jewels or whatever it is, it's going to all pass away when this heaven and earth, this present heaven and earth, are destroyed at the Lord's coming. And so James tells us in verse 3 that if we misuse our wealth, it will become a witness against us in the day of judgment. And this is interesting. This is very interesting. What God is saying is that those who misuse their wealth are going to be called into an account on the day of judgment. In other words, they're going to be judged for how they misuse their wealth. We're all stewards of all that God has given us. And James is saying that those who have lived wickedly, those who have oppressed the poor, those who do not honor God with their wealth, will have their wealth summoned against them as a witness. So he's given like this courtroom picture that our wealth is going to be a witness against us. Imagine what that might look like in the day of judgment for these people here in the first part of James chapter 5. Exhibit A, how they got their wealth. They withheld wages that they were supposed to pay. Exhibit B, how they used their wealth on wanton luxury and pleasure. All for themselves, they hoarded it. They didn't share, they didn't give any of it away. Exhibit C, how they wasted it. And just burned it up on things that were of no account and had no eternal value, and some of it even wickedly. Those things are going to be brought up against them as a witness for them in the divine court on the day of judgment. Now notice what he says in verse 3. Their corrosion will be a witness against you. Isn't that interesting? Their riches have become tarnished or corroded, and God is going to bring even that as a witness against them. The tarnish and corrosion shows how long this stored wealth has been selfishly hoarded. The corrosion is a witness to the greed and the selfishness of those materialistic people, because they would rather let it rot than give it away. And then look at that phrase in verse 3, and it will consume your flesh like fire. What a graphic picture. Oh my goodness. What he's saying is that greed is self-destructive. being selfish, being misers, hoarding our stuff, unwilling to give, unwilling to share with those in need, are actually destructive attitudes and practices that at the end of the day lead to ultimate misery and self-destruction. So the message to us in James 5, 1 through 6, if we can kind of reverse it, is don't let your wealth make you miserable. It can, but it doesn't have to. We're all wealthy people. We're all extremely blessed. And what we have can either make us miserable by how we get it, how we use it, and how we lose it, or we can use it in ways that honor God. And so use it wisely as a good steward of what God has entrusted to you. And I would suggest enjoy some, for God has given us all good things to enjoy. And he blesses us so that we can enjoy some of what he gives us. When he put Adam and Eve in the garden, he didn't say, tend the garden and be miserable. He said, enjoy what I have given to you. Invest some in eternity by supporting the work of God. Give some to the Lord. And thirdly, be willing to share with those who have need, because sharing and giving is a concrete expression of Christian love. And that the way that John puts it, if we see our brother in need and we withhold, we don't give, we don't share some of what we have earned, some of what God has given to us, that question, how does the love of God abide in us? Wealth can make you miserable. Wealth can make all of us miserable. And we're all wealthy people. So while James is speaking primarily to unbelievers here, and he's next week going to say to the believer who is being mistreated by the wealthy, here's how you respond to the mistreatment that you're experiencing. The application broadly to all of us is to use our wealth in godly ways. So let's commit ourselves to do that. Let's stand together as we pray.